Welcome everyone to our second seminar today. Our speaker today is Michael Lubasch. He's visiting from the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen, and we'll talk about developments in computation physics with tensor network states. Okay, go ahead.
So thanks a lot. Yeah. So first of all, I want to thank Dr. Shou Yang, right, for inviting me to come here, and I'm really happy to be here and learn from her and also from the other incredible scientists here at Perimeter Institute, right? And I'm also happy that I can give a talk and advertise a little bit the work that I worked on with several other people, all related to tensor network states. So the this talk was meant to be for a very general audience, right? So also the title is very general. And I already have to apologize if some of the slides might look a bit simple. I really chose from the things that we did, right? From the work we did, I chose like really the simplest kind of results and examples that I thought would be accessible by a general audience, right? So please, if you have, so I apologize already for that, yeah, for those tensor network experts in the audience. So there, so I already apologize for that. And if you're interested in more details, right, in particular, more complicated details, right, I would be very happy to talk to all of you. So I'm here until Sunday. And of course, I would be looking forward to talk to as many people as possible during that time, right? Yeah. And furthermore, so most of the talk, like the major part of this talk is based on finite PEPs and a selection of results from these two articles, right? Yeah. Okay, so let's come to the overview. So like the major part of this talk has to do with finite PEPs algorithms. And so I will briefly motivate why we worked on that, right? I will introduce what finite PEPs are, so give a definition. I will then discuss like a crucial ingredient of all these kind of PEPs algorithms, which is the contraction. And then I will discuss and present some few results on PEPs performance. Then I thought it would be nice to have a few slides on an older work that I worked on which is a PEPs application, yeah, which is a simulation. I thought it fits very well to this PEPs topic of this talk, and also is very well suited for a general audience to give an idea of why we're actually interested in using these PEPs, right? And then I'll, in the last part of this talk, I will present some very preliminary results from some work that I'm working on at the moment regarding the question if we can somehow use tensor network ideas in the context of density functional theory. But this will be very preliminary, and if the time is already too advanced at this moment, I will probably skip some of the slides there. And anybody who's interested in that and has some knowledge on it, I'd be very happy to talk to, right, during my stay here. Okay, so let's come to finite PEPs. So why are we interested in them? Well, so it's one way of generalizing the density matrix minimization group algorithms. So there are many kind of generalizations of that now in this context of tensor network states. And finite PEPs algorithms are one of these generalizations, right, to higher dimensions. And in this talk, I'll just focus on two dimensions, right? And why do we look at these algorithms? The reason is they are rather complex. So one has many possibilities of improving them for a specific problem, and somehow one can tailor the algorithms, right, to be efficient for a specific problem that one has. And so the key question here is somehow, how do I best optimize my algorithm for a given problem, right? So this is like the key motivation for this first part here. So what are finite PEPs? So many of you know this, yeah? But for completeness, let me briefly say a few words. So in this talk, I will focus on finite PEPs as they have been introduced in this article up there. And they are used in as a variational ansatz for a finite system, right, of n quantum spins. And in this talk, I will just consider a two-dimensional square lattice. Yeah. And this ansatz is simply composed of n tensors, so as many tensors as we have quantum spins, and each tensor represents a quantum spin, right? And these tensors can be written in a mathematical notation in such a way that on the square lattice, they are rank 5 tensors, right? They have some indices that I'm writing here in Greek letters, and four of them for the geometry of the lattice and one physical index, this index S. And in the following, I will always use this graphical notation. So that has somehow become standard in this tensor network business to draw these tensors. And in this graphical notation, I draw these Greek letters in this plane. And these Greek letters correspond to the so-called virtual indices. They range from 1 to a so-called bond dimension D, which controls the variational parameters of the ansatz. And the physical index, which I draw perpendicular to this plane, ranges from 1 to the physical dimension, small d, of this physical quantum spin sitting on this side, right? And I compose, I construct the complete ansatz for the state by taking n of these tensors together, right? And here for 4 times 4 lattice, this square lattice, this looks like that. And Andy Ferris was already mentioning such kind of tensor networks. And in this context of this talk, right, what we're approximating is always the coefficients of a wave function. Yeah, so that's where the approximation comes in. So the approximation is such that we're thinking of a quantum spin system of capital N quantum spins, right? And so we can write the wave function in terms of a sum over all possible multi-indices, right, for these quantum spins. And but for PEPs, the approximation we're doing is in these coefficients in such a way that we write them as a product of tensors, right? As a product of n tensors, and by doing that, we don't encounter this problem of exponentially many coefficients to store, right? For a general wave function, we would have to store exponentially many, exponential in this capital N, but using this ansatz, we just have to store these n tensors, right? Just have to work with these n tensors, right? And this picture here corresponds to this to this notation here. And the meaning of this is that these edges, they mean that the corresponding indices of these tensors are summed over, right? So these are just the tensors from the previous slide, putting them next to each other. And now we have a prescription of evaluating this tensor network, which is that we have to sum over these connecting indices. Yeah. So Andy Ferris was already showing this in the previous talk. Yeah, very well explained. So I don't have to go into detail here. And now an issue is that this is also, as already Andy Ferris showed, right? So it's like a 2D classical partition function. And Andy, so this was a topic also of Andy's talk, right? It's difficult to contract this for large systems, right? So it's the same complexity as for 2D classical partition functions one encounters here, yeah? For if one wants to calculate an observable with these 2D PEPs, then this is hard. And it has been proposed, so already with this original, in this original article, it has been proposed how to do this, so one can do it approximately, yeah? And for this, we follow the following procedure. So for contracting the norm, which is something one needs all the time in these algorithms, either for calculating observables or for performing variational updates, so for variationally approximating time-evolved or ground states, one always needs to perform this contraction. So what we do for that is we look at the tensor network corresponding to this norm value, right? And for that, we just take the cat as a PEPs and the bra as a PEPs, and we put them together. And what you see here now is certainly a tensor network where we just have only edges, right? There are no more open indices, so it's really a number in the end, right? And exactly as it should be, right? Because this kind of norm squared is just a scalar, right? And in order to evaluate this number, we just change the point of the perspective on this tensor network. And then what we do is we approximate a two-dimensional tensor network, which is hard to contract, right? Which has this same complexity as these 2D classical partition functions that Andy Ferris was talking about. We approximate this by a one-dimensional tensor network, right? Which is efficient to contract. It's like a 1D classical partition function where the evaluation just consists of calculating a product of matrices, right? And some vectors. And this can be done can be done successively. So and one procedure to perform this successively. So Andy was showing one procedure, and one procedure to perform this is to always approximate, like to introduce a boundary operator, which is a one-dimensional object as shown here, right? With some whose variational parameters are defined and controlled by a boundary bond dimension capital D prime, and then to always have this boundary operator acting on a row, yeah, a certain row of your two-dimensional tensor network, and always approximate this by this product of these two by a single one, right? And this one can do successively, yeah, and there's a certain cost associated with this, but let me show it explicitly on a simple, by means of a simple example, right? Then you see it. So it's very similar to what Andy was showing already. So what we're doing is, now I'm just looking at a bit larger system, right? The 7x7 PEPs, and I'm looking at this norm tensor network again. So the exact contraction is hard, and we want to use this approximate procedure to perform this contraction. So in the first step, we just approximate the outermost boundary by a single of these operators, and we find this tensor network now, right? And now we approximate the action of this on the second row by a single of these boundary operators, and now we approximate the action of the single operator on the next one by a single one, and this is how we proceed from above, and we do the same from below, and this is. This is just how we end up with a one-dimensional tensor network, right? Exactly. And all these approximations can be done by minimizing certain cost functions. So they are, in a sense, they can be seen as, each step of this procedure can be seen as something optimal. So one can choose these boundary operators in a way optimal. But it also has a certain cost, right? And the cost is written down here in a typical calculation. So the calculations I encounter typically in my problems, this D prime, so this boundary bond dimension, had to be chosen proportional to D squared, yeah? To get a result independent of system size. I saw that typically I had to choose this D prime proportional to D squared, yeah? Not proportional to the system size anymore, but proportional to D squared. Such that this cost in the end is proportional to d to the 10, yeah? And this is really then like the cost one encounters all the time in these kind of algorithms, something proportional to d to the 10, right? And so what we were asking ourselves, can we somehow reduce this cost, right? And of course, we weren't the first ones to ask this question. So there were many articles and many very good ideas, right? But what we wanted to achieve is like reduce the cost without reducing the precision. So our aim was, of course, one can come up with a scheme of performing these contractions in such a way that this cost is highly reduced. Yeah, but which kind of error function do you minimize then, right? Or, I mean, one always has to ask, which precision do you lose, right? And we wanted to really have something that is as precise as the previous, is the best contraction algorithm, right? But reduces the cost. Yeah. And this we achieved with a very simple idea, namely the idea of clusters, right? And the idea of clusters is can be summarized in a, relatively quickly. So it's just that if we have an observable on a central letter site like here, we just define a cluster of a certain size around this central site. Or for instance, if we want to optimize tensors on these two letter sites, we would also have a cluster around these two letter sites, and then everything outside the cluster is approximated very roughly. And here I'm just using a bond dimension d prime equal to 1, right? And I'm doing this from above and from below. And then this cost is really negligible, yeah? So this is d to the 5. This is very cheap, yeah? So all the other costs of the algorithm, this is very cheap. And only inside the cluster, we use a larger value of d prime, yeah? And in the case of such a small cluster, this also reduces the cost compared to the previous contraction scheme, yeah. And now we have to ask the question: how does the precision behave if we work with small clusters, right? And here we obtained this this somewhat nice result that. So what I'm now looking at is some examples, yeah, for this cluster precision, and I'm taking ground state approximations of a 21 times 21 quantum easing model, right? So that's the Hamiltonian on the right. So for this Hamiltonian, we just ran our algorithm to approximate ground states for different bond dimensions 2, 3, and 4, and for different magnetic fields. And what I'm showing here is for three example PEPs that we obtained in this way for different magnetic fields, how this cluster contraction error. So this is really the error in computing a local observable sigma z on a central side in such a cluster of size delta relative to the exact value of the sigma z, and the exact value is obtained by using the most precise contraction with the largest value of d prime that we can access and checking that this converges with the value of d prime. Yeah, so this is a very precise procedure, and it doesn't. One can really say that the contraction error, at least within the method that we have, yeah, is negligible. Yeah, exactly. So, as you correctly say, yeah, we can compare the slope of that to the slope of the correlation functions. So it's very intuitive, right? That to expect that, and indeed, if we plot them in the inside. They also, when these curves decay slower, also the correlation functions decay slower, right? Then we can just make an exponential fit to these curves and look at many other PEPs, right? So we just looked at all kinds of PEPs that we had and we find that, so by doing such a fit, we can define something like a characteristic cluster size, right? Which dictates how the error behaves if we use a finite cluster, and for the same states, PEPs, right, we can look at their correlation lengths, right? And we can compare then how this cluster, characteristic cluster size compares to this correlation length, and one obtains this very, very, very straightforward and somewhat intuitive result, right? That this delta zero has to be similar to the correlation length, right? And what it means is that it provides a very direct way of understanding like the computational cost of working with a certain PEPs, right, in terms of its physical properties. Yeah, so that's kind of nice. It's a very simple result, right? But yeah, and okay, so that's one aspect that we studied, right, and something that I thought is nice to present to a general audience. And of course we studied many other different aspects that come into PEPs algorithms, into especially finite PEPs algorithms, and for critical magnetic field, you need to use an extremely large cluster. So if you would say that your correlation length diverges, you would have to do a precise contraction of the whole system. So there wouldn't be any gain for. There wouldn't be a gain for a critical system by using these clusters, right?
Like starting from a small cluster, you're going to be able to do some scaling like that.
That's a good idea, yeah. So one could do this. We didn't do this, yeah. 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 Okay. So we looked also at many other aspects, right? And anybody who's interested, I'm very happy to talk to. So after having improved many different aspects also on in these kind of algorithms, we also studied the performance, right? And I would like to present one example of this performance comparison, namely simply for this Heisenberg model. So for this Heisenberg model, one gets very precise results from quantum Monte Carlo, right? For very large system sizes, and so we can study how our ansatz, so this finite PEPS ansatz, describes ground states of this two-dimensional Heisenberg model on a 2D square lattice as a function of the bond dimension, right? So we can ask the question, is this the right ansatz for ground states of the Hamiltonian, right? And and what I'm plotting here is just the energy error, right? As a function, the relative energy error as a function of the bond dimension. And one roughly can say, right, for this bond dimensions 2 to 6, that this roughly decreases exponentially, right, as a bond dimension, yeah, as a function of the bond dimension. So somehow indicating that the ansatz is correct. And however, if we're using another algorithm, right, which has been widely used in the community, namely the simple update, so which corresponds in our notation to cluster size 0. So this we checked. So it's really the same kind of algorithm. Then the energy seem to saturate, right? And of course this is just the energy, but if we look at the order parameter, it looks even a bit worse, right? For the simple update. So if we use like our largest clusters for these kind of updates. And what I'm showing here is now the relative error of this spin-spin correlator, right, which enters into the order parameter of such a finite 2D Heisenberg antiferromagnet.
Is this an open periodic system?
That's open. Yeah. So it's really open, and I really compare the results to open boundary condition quantum Monte Carlo results. So it's a 14 times 14 lattice, and L is just in the center. So I'm taking in the center of the lattice. I'm just considering a distance x, right? And I put them as far away, both of them, as far away from the boundaries as possible. Exactly, And what we see if we study the relative position of that, so if we fix a certain bond dimension, right, then one clearly can see that the error increases as this distance increases, right? But if we fix a certain distance, so for instance, this is a 14 times 14 lattice, so we might fix, let's say, something in the center, so 7 or something like that, right? Then we observe that as we increase the bond dimension, we again, since from 2 to 4 to 6, that's equidistant, right? And this is a log plot. We again observe an exponential improvement, right, towards the exact value. So somehow indicating, right, that the ansatz not only gets the energy well, but also the order parameter. And this has been in previous studies, this hasn't been so obvious, especially not with so small bond dimensions. So it was really something that that we could see thanks to many improvements on the algorithms, and those were always improvements where our aim was not to reduce the precision, right? So it was clearly our aim was to get to larger bond dimensions, but at the same time not to lose precision, right? And in particular, if one compares these results to the simple update results, then one sees for simpler update, we can go to larger bond dimensions like 4, 6, and 8, right, compared to 2, 4, and 6 here. But all these errors, they are between our d equals 2 and 4 results, right? So for the simple update, we have a cost which is like d to the 5 in the algorithm. So it allows us actually to go to bond dimension 20 without problems, right? But what one sees now is that somehow the error seems to converge. So it looks like if you just use this algorithm, right, it looks like the ansatz is wrong, right? So the ansatz doesn't, so if it converges at an error of, let's say, 10 to the minus 1, right, so 10%, then you might say maybe the ansatz captures the energy correctly, but the order parameter doesn't capture correctly, right? But this is an artifact of the algorithm you're using, right, in this context. So this was something that we investigated and found like this, right? Yeah. Okay, so this ends this part on studying or looking at PEPS algorithms specifically. And I would now come to a part where I present, on a few slides, I present an application where we...
Sort of one dimension, one outside of the cluster. When the ones the cluster is bigger, is it really switching from like one dimension one up to some value once you enter the cluster, or is it like you simply have like smaller, you know, truncate more further away and sort of gradually truncate less as you come closer?
So you can, I mean, what you're saying is you can do that. So you can truncate. So you can have your d prime increase slowly, right? So the truth. So the short answer to your question is, so for clusters size zero, the cost is like d to the 5, and the algorithm is very similar, and in fact coincides in many aspects with the simple update, yeah, which also has this d to the 5. And for cluster size 1, the algorithm has a cost, I think it's d to the 9, so it's still lower than d to the 10, right? But from cluster size 2 on, you just have d to the 10 again. So the gain is not in the scaling with d, but in the fact that you have this exponential improvement with so if you have a finite cluster size, right? If you have a finite correlation length in your state, then your precision improves exponentially fast with your cluster size. So you can choose very small clusters. For 21 times 21 easing system, like a cluster, if you're away from the critical point, a cluster size of 2 or 3 might already be enough to convert your result. So you don't need to contract 21 times 21 letters, but just like a 4 times 4 letters or something like this. So the improvement comes from the from these individual row-row approximations, of which you need less if your correlation length is finite. Yeah.
Have you looked at how, if you consider directly a 4 times 4 system, you know, you're talking about advantage that you obtain by using a cluster of data,
yeah,
rather than the correlation length in the system is small enough compared,
yeah,
to the size of the cluster. So the question is, what are the rest of the spins doing for you in this larger system? You're considering 21 times 21 spins.
Yes.
Right? What if you just study 8 times 8 spins? Will you see any change in observables, in going from 8 times 8 to 21 times 21? You're saying that you need a small correlation length.
Yes. So
supposedly the system size will not affect the results.
That's what I would expect, yes.
So then what's the merit of having an update that only looks locally at your wave function?
Yes.
I mean, what this is telling you is that you could consider smaller clusters to begin with, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, I think you have to take into account with our ansatz that we always have open boundary conditions.
Right.
So that so it's not like an IPEPS. So I would consider like in an IPEPS, one could do this, right? And say just one increases the cluster size and studies how by increasing the cluster size, the results converge. But here, so somehow here, if I'm asking myself, what is the ground state given given open boundary conditions, then I have to calculate the energy observables over all sides,
okay,
also the ones on the boundaries. So I also have to converge the boundary sides to get a good energy value.
All I'm asking is, why do you want to study, in a system where with a small correlation line,
yes,
why do you want to study a 21 times 21 lattice? Why are you interested in this system? I'm not. What do you learn by studying 21 times 21 spins that you would not learn by studying 8 times 8, a lattice of 8 times 8? I understand that the ground state energy is going to be different.
Yes.
But are you learning anything from, you know, 21 times 21 spins?
If the correlation lengths are so small, right? That's what.
That's my question. I mean, I'm pretty sure that you still get some advantage by considering this cluster update, but when you try to describe the disadvantage, the advantage that cluster update gives you, I'm guessing that you should also mention that you are, you know, that this cluster update gives you an advantage when the system size is not really that important anymore.
Yeah. So I think so the reason why we went and then looked at a 21x21 system was because we wanted to compare our results to IPEP's results, which are in the thermodynamic limit, right? So we wanted to compare the this phase diagram curve of the sigma z expectation value, this was the only reason why we looked at a 21x21 system, because we wanted to have a system size where the sigma z expectation value looks similar to the IPEPS results, and so we could compare our results from finite PEPS, for instance, for this expectation value, as well, so evaluated just in the center, right, to simplify things, and for the correlation functions. So we could compare both this value as well as the correlation functions with IPEPS results. That's why we went to these large 21x21 system. That's the only reason. But your question makes absolute sense there. So it's also true that what I was looking for were states with large correlation lengths, right? And I was hoping that when I go to larger systems at the critical point with this quantum easing model, right, that I get states with larger correlation lengths. Simply because in the thermodynamic limit, the exact ground state should have divergent correlation length, right, at the critical point. And so my motivation was to go from a 8x8 to a 15x15 to a 21x21 lattice to see that if I'm at the critical point, that the correlation length increases, and I can better make this statement, right, regarding the precision. So I get a larger variation of PEPs with a larger variation of correlation length, for which I could compare to the cluster convection error. That was another reason. So, okay. Now, one aspect that finite PEPs are good for, right? So it's a good question why actually we're using finite PEPs to describe these ground states, right? Because for finite PEPs, for 21x21 lattice, one pays the price of updating 21x21 tensors, yeah? So doing a finite size scaling with this, so going, for instance, from a 8x8 to a 15x15 to a 21x21 lattice and performing a finite size scaling might not be necessary, because there are IPEPs there, right? And in terms of IPEPs, one would just choose a unit cell and update the tensors in the unit cell, right? And maybe a small unit cell surfaces, or one studies the convergence with the unit cell, but one is always directly in the thermodynamic limit, right? So this analysis with these systems for these ground states was just to benchmark our algorithmic improvements, right? So it was not meant to be better than IPEPS results or to get anything more precise that has been obtained so far. It was just to benchmark our improvements, right? A big application area for finite PEPs is to study inhomogeneous finite systems. And that's what this second part of my talk is about. So an example where we use this ansatz to simulate an experiment, yeah? And the experiment is like an optical lattice experiment with an inhomogeneous trap. And for this, really, this ansatz is perfect, right? Yeah. And the goal of this, or the title of this project was somehow like adiabatic preparation of a Heisenberg antiferromagnet in an optical lattice, yeah? And let me briefly motivate this project. So the motivation comes from trying to simulate a TJ model. So this model, as many of you know, yeah? It might give, or it's related to, or it's a candidate explanation for high temperature superconductivity in cuprates, right? However, it's hard to simulate by classical computers, right? So for instance, quantum Monte Carlo methods have a sign problem. And on the other hand, ultra cold fermions in optical lattices are described by such an Hamiltonian. Yeah, they're strongly interacting. So so it might be feasible to study this Hamiltonian and the properties of this Hamiltonian by a quantum simulator that's based on ultra cold fermions and optical lattices. But the question there is, how cold do they have to be? So this is somehow the experimental question. And that's why we worked on this. So somehow, so what has been done experimentally is, fermionic atoms have been cooled into optical lattices, and the Hamiltonian, like this fermionic Hubbard model, containing a nearest neighbor hopping, right, and pure on-site interaction of neutral atoms, has been realized, right, in the lowest band, and several phases have been mapped out. So, for instance, when the tunneling is the dominant energy scale, the atoms just delocalize over the lattice, and one obtains, and such a phase has been seen, right? So when the on-site interaction is the dominant term, then one has at most one atom per site, and they are localized like this, right? And when the trap strength is the dominant force, the dominant energy scale, one has two atoms per lattice site, and has such a band insulator, yeah. And this has been seen and observed experimentally. However, and we are interested in this regime here, where the on-site interaction is the dominant energy scale. And here one would expect to see some order in these kind of two species of fermionic atoms, right? And this order could not be seen clearly yet in experiments, because temperatures were simply still too high to see this magnetic order. Yeah. So that's a very, very low energy scale, for which then also very, very low entropies and temperatures have to be achieved, right? And so this was the situation. Now experimentalists have achieved much lower temperatures now, and they're really getting close to realizing and observing this order over many length scales. And somehow what we worked on was, can we come up with a procedure that allows to prepare this state with low entropy, right, and low temperature? And this was this adiabatic protocol that we worked on. And the idea is simple. So the idea is that we have, so it proceeds in these three steps. So first, a band insulator is created in such an optical lattice, and such a state can be created with very low entropy. Yeah, that's what experimentalists told us, that they can do this, and one can also understand it, because there are not many configurations there, right? Such a state has low entropy, and it can be prepared with low entropy. And then the idea was to switch on a second lattice, a super lattice of half the wavelength, in such a way that such dimers are realized in the original lattice. And then in this last step, to switch off adiabatically the initial lattice to realize the final state as we want to have it. Yeah. So the Hamiltonian of this final state here is the Hamiltonian that we want to have, right? We want to have the ground state of this Hamiltonian here. But we're starting from the ground state of a Hamiltonian that can be achieved experimentally with lower entropy, right? And then the key question is, so if all these steps here are truly adiabatic, entropy should remain constant, right? And so the low entropy from here should also be present here, right? So very low entropy. So the question is, how slowly do these ramps of optical lattices have to be done such that really the entropy stays low, right? So are these ramping times for experimentally feasible system sizes, are these experimentally feasible ramping times, right? Or, I mean, it could be, one could imagine that that the necessary ramping time to have all this process be done adiabatically, that this scales horribly with system size, right? One could imagine that. And And so with our MPS and PEPS algorithms, we could simulate this protocol and also include, let's say, all kinds of experimental imperfections. We could look at the spreading of holes, so how temperature affects this kind of procedure, and also study then all these questions for experimental observables, right? So at the very end, experimentalists will measure something and then conclude from the measurement, we have achieved this and that fidelity, right, with the final state. And we could do this, like with these kind of algorithms, one can do this for realistic system sizes in 1D, right, and for relatively large systems in 2D, and take all these things into account. And we also could like develop effective theories for the spreading of holes and compare these with our numerics, and it all worked out very nice. So this was a very, very a rewarding project. Many things worked out there very, very directly. And I thought it was nice to show as an application, right? Because it shows somehow where finite PEPs like can be used very well to perform real-time evolution calculations. Yeah. Okay. This brings me to the last part of my talk, which is... I'm just discussing some. Yeah.
What was the result? I mean, can you do a quick link up experiment?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. So. no. So I didn't want to go too much into detail, right?
And were you doing like some sort of TBD with PEPs? Is this really dynamic? So were you just looking at the gap, or?
No, it's real time evolution. So we really.
PEPs.
Yeah. So we did real-time evolution with PEPs, and we studied, for instance, how does the harmonic trap, right?
The bond dimension seemed to be big enough for this.
Well, we used we check convergence with this bond dimension, right? So
that's cool.
And of course this this allowed us then to make predictions for experiments, right? So in 1D, the system sizes we could study were really the ones that experimentalists can look at, right? And in two dimensions, it was like 14 times 14 letters. Mm-hmm. So in this case, that's relatively large for these kind of PEPS calculations, right? But experimentalists, of course, they can go to even larger, I mean, super large two-dimensional systems, right? Yeah. Okay. So this brings me to the last slide. So these are just preliminary results, and what we're doing here is basically approximating the universal functional. So what's the motivation of this project? So here the motivation is that density functional theory, as many of you know, can deal with realistic materials, right? So really three-dimensional continuous problems, like huge molecules or systems of hundreds of atoms taking all electrons into account. So density functional theory is extremely, extremely powerful. Yeah. However, typically it's not so easy to systematically improve a final DFT result. Yeah. So within density functional theory, there have been many incredible improvements. And also systematic ways of improving results. So one can say, for instance, there's the local density approximation, and then beyond the local density approximation, there are these generalized gradient approximations. Beyond these generalized gradient approximations, there's the meta GGA. So there's a systematic way, but at some point it becomes difficult to get further. So going beyond meta GGA, at least that's what our collaborators, which are DFT experts, tell us, it gets more difficult. Yeah, and on the other hand, with tensor network states, it's it's simple to systematically improve results, simply because one uses tensors, right? And one can just increase tensor dimensions. So this is the way that we check convergence with our PEPS calculations or with MPS calculations, right? So the question here is just, can we somehow merge the good properties of DFT with tensor network states, right? And the setting for our analysis is just a toy setting. So it's not it's not a three-dimensional DFT setting and not continuous space, but we consider a one-dimensional discretized and finite lattice, so of lattice size small l, and a total lattice length of capital L, right? And on this lattice, we have a density, right? So that's a finite dimensional vector of just the entries, just being the density values on the different lattice sides, right? And the two Hamiltonians that I will consider in this talk is just a Hubbard model that we had already seen before. So it has a local hopping, a nearest neighbor hopping, sorry, and a local on-site interaction. And it has this potential term here, right, to allow for an arbitrary external potential. And also what we consider is a soft Coulomb Hamiltonian. So here we have, again, a nearest neighbor hopping. We have a non-local long-range interaction, which is meant to represent the Coulomb interaction, but we're adding a plus one here, so which makes it, people call it then soft Coulomb, to circumvent any problems of L being equal to M, right? So that's why we add this plus one here. And we also have, again, this general external potential. Okay, and given this setting, given this toy setting, what we're interested in is to approximate the universal functional. And this universal functional can be derived in very few steps. That's why I just wanted to present it here. In this process of energy minimization, right? So if you're interested in the ground state energy, then then in a variational wave function based procedure, what you say is that your ground state energy is the minimum over all wave functions of this expectation value here, right? And I'm assuming here that the wave functions are normalized to one, yeah. And now, in order to derive this universal functional, we can now go in two steps. That's the idea. Yeah. Every wave function has associated to it specific density values. Right. That's clear, because we can just evaluate the density for every wave function on every side. Right. So we can do this in two steps. So we can say that we minimize over all possible values of n an expression that is fixed after we have fixed a specific value of n. Right. So given that fixed, then here we just minimize over all wave functions that lead to this density vector n. Yeah, that's the idea. And if we now plug in a general Hamiltonian of the kind that we had seen before, so of some kinetic and interaction term plus some external potential term, then we see that this external potential part is already evaluated, right? In these brackets, we have already fixed the density vector, so that these values are trivial. This part is trivial, and we just have to evaluate and find a form for this part here. And it's exactly this part here, which is the universal functional. Yeah. So we can now restate this energy minimization with the help of this universal functional, simply as a minimization over the sum of these two terms. Right. So given a universal functional, and given a certain external potential, we can find the ground state energy and corresponding ground state density for this problem, right? That's the idea, by minimizing over density values. And so the idea is now to find approximations for F, yeah? So that's it's not trivial. So the idea is now to somehow, yeah, by tensor network ideas, find good approximations for this exact functional f, yeah, and in the following slides I will call our approximations. I will call this just our ansatz, yeah, to simplify the terminology. Exactly, and this ansatz should have some properties, right? So it should be like efficiently storable, like tensor network ansatzes, right? Should have properties like that. And of course, the first thing one can try, and that's what we did, right? So we could ask ourselves, So first of all, we can for small systems, right? We can construct this tensor FHK. We can just compute it exactly. So for density values in a certain range and for certain problems, we can just calculate this tensor. And it's a tensor with capital N legs, right? So as many legs as letter sides. So in general, it will be exponentially large. But for small systems, we can just take a look at it. And for instance, ask ourselves, can we approximate it by an MPS, right? And there.
So this density is a quantized?
Yeah, yeah. So we discretize the lattice in this density.
So in the standard molecules, free space, continuum stuff, it's continuous, right?
It's continuous, yes.
Okay.
So this is still a toy, right?
Yeah.
It's still a toy. That's true, yes. But in this context, we're really discretizing space.
And this was only just the product state?
Not space, I mean the density. The density aside can't be 0.4, can it?
Please?
The density of given matter side can't be 0.4, can it?
Not on this side.
Yeah.
Not on this side.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you.
Is this general functional depend on the hopping amplitude?
Yeah, yeah. So it depends on the hopping, right? And on the interaction. So you will get a different functional if you change your kinetic term or your interaction term.
Okay.
But you can imagine that this functional shall contain the information for all kinds of external potentials, right? So it has to contain the complete density and ground state energy information for critical systems, right? So it's a highly, highly complex object, right? So it's not clear a priori if approximations work at all, right? Yeah. Okay, and the first step was this MPS approximation, but I don't want to spend too much time on this because in the end, this didn't work so well for larger systems, yeah? So let me tell you what we did then, because we came up then with something like an ansatz that we are now using, which looks much more promising and has many nice properties also with respect to other necessary constraints that we still have to satisfy with our approximations. And this ansatz is better explained down here. So it contains, so it's a sum of many terms, and these terms depend on the letter side. So it's a finite system with open boundary conditions. So we somehow don't make use of translational invariants or something like this, and we have terms that just depend on the density on the very side which they are defined on, which is similar to the local density approximation, and then we have terms and all the other terms depend on densities on two sides, right? And this is done in a systematic way so that we first have a sum over terms where these densities on the two sides are just separated by distance one, right? And then we have terms where they are separated by distance two, and then we have terms where they're separated by distance three, and so on, right? So that in the end, we have also we can also have terms where they're separated by the whole lattice length, right? So that by increasing this value of capital X, one increases the non-locality of this ansatz. And hopefully increases somehow the precision of the final result, right? While at the same time, all these terms, for instance, if they are seen as tensors, where these values are discretized, right? Just living on a predefined grid, they can be stored efficiently, right? It's just whatever the discretization here is to the power 2, and then you still have on the order of L of those, right? And depending on how many distances you take into account, you still have another factor in front, but it's all efficient, right, to store. Yeah. And so we somehow this was our ansatz, and then we defined a reasonable cost function to minimize the distance to the previous universal functional, and ran our algorithm, and however, it was not clear if anything reasonable comes out, and so we had to check our results to physically reasonable results. Yeah, so anything could come out of like like such an ansatz with a certain cost function, right? And some reasonable results that physically should be captured by our ansatz are small perturbations around a homogeneous density. So the idea of this is that the exactly homogeneous density can be described by a local density approximation, and if you include small variations around this, you could expand this as a Taylor expansion, and this was nice to see for us. So if we plot the local terms obtained by our fitting, so this is now like a black box. So I'm not going into detail here, but we somehow fit our ansatz to minimize a certain cost function. And after we have obtained then our solution, we can look at the solution, right? And the solution clearly, it looks very simple, right? Very harmonic. And in fact, it's exactly for slight variations around uniform densities, we exactly obtain this Taylor expansion, right? So that's nice. And also for the non-local terms, we can in this way validate that our procedure, our fitting procedure, does the correct thing, yeah? And however, we wanted also to go to larger systems and also include continuous interpolations, right? So we wanted to capture all density values in all possible density values. And so what we did then was we expressed our ansatz with the help of cubic splines. So in this way, we could still keep the tensor optimization routines and so on, but have a cubic spline interpolation between points. And also we wanted to go to larger systems where we could not calculate the exact functional for all possible density values anymore. And so we considered physically motivated training sets. So that's the setting for the following slide. And also like a goal was now to have target sets which are different from the training sets, right? So to see really that we train with something but use it somewhere else, right? So this is a standard. All this I would say are reasonable assumptions, right? For any kind of functional constructed for DFT, right? And in this context for larger systems, so we could then show that our black box procedure to calculate the local terms really reproduced also for homogeneous cases the LDA, right? Or something similar to the exact LDA in the non-intacting as well as in the intacting case. So this was somehow the check that we did. And then we asked ourselves, how does it perform for actual problems, right? And this is shown now on these last two remaining slides. So what I'm showing here is exactly this procedure, right? So given a certain training set, we fit our ansatz for that, but then we applied to a different target set, yeah? And in this case, we are considering non-interacting fermions. And what I'm showing here is the relative error, the mean relative error of our ansatz as a function of this value x, right? Which allows to increase the non-locality. And I'm showing this error once for the training set, for which it should be the best, right? Because we train for with this. And then I'm also showing it for a target set, right? And it's still decreasing monotonically, right? And we're comparing this to these exact LDA results, which are much higher, right? So somehow that's what
exact doesn't really mean exact.
It doesn't mean exact. Yeah, it's exact. Well, it's in this context for these kind of systems, it's the most reasonable way of constructing an LDA, right? So it's the corresponding LDA for this system, yeah. And if we go to interactions, although the error gets a bit larger, right? The overall value, we still have this this decrease in both. Well, when using our ansatz, right, by increasing the non-locality in it, yeah. Exactly, and this brings me to the end of my slides. So, so in conclusion, I've sketched some of our finite PEPS results, right? So we studied many things, and I've made a focus on this PEPS contraction, and in particular the cluster, this cluster contraction idea, right? So I presented also some Heisenberg results, to illustrate the performance of this ansatz, right? Then I had a few slides on an application of finite PEPs, where finite PEPs are expected to be particularly well suited, right, for the simulation of time evolved non-homogeneous systems, right, like an optical lattice experiment. And in the last part, I presented some very preliminary results, namely on this question if somehow one can combine tensor networks with density functional theory, right? And this is work in progress, together with Johanna Fuchs. So she's a postdoc in Nepa Maitra's group in City University of New York. Then Heiko Appel, Angel Rubio. So Heiko Appel is in Germany, I think in Berlin, and Angel Rubio is, I think, in Spain and also in Hamburg, I think. And Marikam Banyul and Ignacio Sirac from the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Optics. Right. And with this, I thank you for your attention.
So this question may be a bit out of the loop. When you optimize the evaluation of a tensor network, you kind of assume that you evaluate it in serial, don't you? One after the other.
Yeah, that's so, yes.
Do you also have ideas how that could be done in parallel?
Yeah, of course. So we investigated exactly this this question for these clusters, right? So the idea is if you have a 21 times 21 PEPs, right? It holds, right? What Professor Vidal was saying, namely that it doesn't matter, right? If you do something here, like on one end of this PEPs, because it's so large and the correlation length is small, so one has to assume if the correlation length is small, then doing a change in this end, right, of the PEPs doesn't affect the change here, right? And so you can do these updates in parallel. So I implemented this, and it works very well. So I had one code where the updates per one single time step, right, are done by sweeping over the PEPs. So sweeping until convergence for one time step. And I had another code where the updates were done for different clusters for one time step in parallel, right? And looking at the final curve of the convergence of the energy of these two codes, right?
Curve against time,
okay. Right? So energy against time, these curves were lying on top of each other.
Iteration number,
yeah.
Yes, that's the idea.
Yeah. No, that's all point. Yeah, not in wall time, right? Yeah. Yeah.
When comparing the network, is there a simple way to keep the top-end Hermitian?
To keep it Hermitian?
Yeah, because the top-end have two layers.
Yes.
So
what we studied was if it's possible to keep it positive.
Yeah.
So Hermitian, it turns out, at least in my calculations, but I never questioned that. They were always Hermitian. So in this approximation, sweeping, right? So I can tell you the details of this because I really looked at it. Yeah. In this approximation, a question was if we can make it positive. That's what we studied, and if in this sweeping algorithm, which is people call it often alternating least squares, so minimizing this MPS minus MPS cost function, so this L2 norm that Andy Ferris was showing in his talk, by optimizing one tensor at a time, and assuming that all the others are fixed, so minimizing this cost function each time. For this very tensor, on the assumption that all the other tensors are fixed, you can find this tensor at this site in such a way that it's positive, but you have to solve a nonlinear problem then. And so the cost function is quartic in this tensor variables. So what I used was three different algorithms to perform this optimization. So I used a conjugate gradient, I used the linearization method, and I used the Newton method to find this minimum of this nonlinear equations, right? And in the end, the best method was the Newton method. So it converged really in very few steps to a low value and gave me a positive solution at this very site. But this was positive in a restricted way. So it had a specific structure, namely being positive by the structure x times x dagger. So you might come up with a different algorithm if you just say that you have a single tensor there and you want it to be positive. Yeah, but I didn't come up with any idea in this direction. So it was positive because I was searching for x times x dagger, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Then let's thank you again.
Thank you.